I'm John Kroll. Bike to Work Day is tomorrow. In anticipation of the occasion, we're going to talk today on No Limits about efforts to make Indianapolis more bike-friendly. My guests are Kim Irwin, Executive Director of Health by Design, Damon Richards with Bike Indianapolis, and Scott Manning with the Indiana Department of Transportation. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. I'm John Kroll. Welcome to No Limits. I'm your host today. We're going to be talking about Bike to Work Day and efforts to make Indianapolis more bike-friendly. My guests are Kim Irwin, Executive Director of Health by Design, Damon Richards with Bike Indianapolis, and Scott Manning with the Indiana Department of Transportation. I'd say welcome to all of you, but you're all veterans of the program, so I guess it's more appropriate to say welcome back.
Thank you.
And I should say to our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Damon, I'm going to start with you. Why don't you tell us first a little bit about what Bike to Work Day is, and then we'll get into the broader topic.
Sure. Well, as most people know, May is not only race month, it is bike month nationally. And Bike to Work Day is an event that started back in 1956 by the League of American Bicyclists to encourage people to take an alternative form of transportation to work just one day a year. So the goal is to get those folks who've been thinking, and maybe I could ride my bike to work to come out and ride with a lot of other people. So there's a comfort level to trying it out that first time. And hopefully a few of them will like it and keep doing it.
So I'm kind of curious. If it started in 1956, don't worry. We will get to the larger subject in hand. Yeah, how successful was it back then? I mean, in those days you had vehicles that, you know, that were a city block long, and basically you had to plan your turns at least 3 weeks in advance. So.
Well, they started in the larger cities.
Okay.
And in fact, it's really a big event in a lot of larger cities. San Francisco does an amazing job at Bike to Work Day, and they have events all over the city. I happened to be in Washington, D.C. on Bike to Work Day a few years ago, and as I rode through the city, I got to eat donuts at a lot of places because they were set up to feed the riders. And hopefully we'll get to that point here in Indianapolis at some point. But right now, we try to concentrate everybody into coming downtown to Monument Circle, where we'll start the festivities tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. We have fabulous breakfast treats from Obon Pan on the Circle and a special Bike Indianapolis blend coffee. So it's a good start.
So, Scott, how many people do you anticipate are going to be doing this tomorrow? Do you have any idea? Or is it something where we've tracked figures on this? Do we have any information? Damon, he's looking toward Damon here, so we'll let him throw the lifeline
it's
over
It's hard
there.
To keep track of figures, particularly because we do this one location down a circle, so we're appealing to people who commute to downtown. So if you work in Park 100, you're not going to ride your bike downtown and then ride to work. So more people participate than come downtown. And who rides that morning is very weather dependent. There are a lot of regular commuters who are going to show up regardless of the weather. But if we have nice weather, we could see 500 or 600 people. If we have crummy weather.
Just at your location.
Yeah, if we have crummy weather, we could see 70.
Okay. And, you know, Kim, could you talk a little bit about what efforts are being made to encourage people to, to bike to work tomorrow?
Sure, absolutely. So certainly there's a lot of promotional activity around the day itself and encouraging people to participate. There are bike trains that leave from several parts of the city that people can join if they're interested. But I think the work that we do in partnership with Bike Indianapolis, with NDOT, with the Department of Public Works here in Indianapolis is very much about creating environments where people can bike every day mm-hmm. and feel like that's a safe, convenient, you know, choice for them. And so beyond the promotion and festivities associated with tomorrow, you know, we're really all working to expand the infrastructure to ensure that there are, you know, bikeways, trails, safe crossings, safe infrastructure so that people can bike, walk, even ride transit to get where they need to go.
Scott, what are some of the challenges in terms of the infrastructure of having people starting to use bikes more often as
sure.
primary transportation?
Well, I think probably the greatest challenge is evolving our infrastructure network to a point where it is accessible and usable for multiple modes of transportation at a level that people feel comfortable, using it regardless of skill level. I know in the bike community, one of the common themes you hear is from 8 to 80. So mm-hmm. having infrastructure that is comfortable for a young bicyclist all the way up to somebody that is an older, more experienced user. So in many cases, infrastructure, whether it's at the local street level all the way up to the state highway system, in many cases was designed with the automobile being, if not the sole user, the primary mode of transportation. So, the challenge that we have to make the system more adaptive and more friendly to multiple modes of transportation is sort of reimagining and redesigning that infrastructure as we update it and make improvements so that it can be used by a wider range of transportation options that exist now that maybe weren't as widely used or as prominent years ago.
If you are just joining us, tomorrow is Bike to Work Day. We're talking today on No Limits about efforts to make Indianapolis more bike friendly. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Scott, I'm going to stay with you. I mean, in terms of making that infrastructure more flexible, what are the primary challenges there? Because, infrastructure in some ways, by definition, is not designed to be flexible. Once streets have been laid, it's not like you can say, snap your fingers and say, oh, my goodness, we're going to move the houses back 4 feet to create a bike lane.
Sure. And I think you just alluded to one of the primary challenges that in terms of kind of redesigning infrastructure and introducing a flexibility that doesn't exist is, if our goal is to accommodate multiple modes of transportation. So I'll take a city, basic city street in the downtown Indianapolis grid as an example. If we are to work within the existing right of way and we want to add a bike lane or a protected cycle track or, maybe build out a wider sidewalk for pedestrian, for more pedestrians or shared pedestrian bicyclist facility, oftentimes we're taking a vehicle travel lane out doing what's called a road diet or, expanding the roadway, which requires, purchasing additional right of way. Sometimes that's not ideal and in some cases impossible to do. So it really is incumbent on, the engineering community, civil engineering, design engineering community, working with the urban planning community to look at our spaces and really try to be very cognizant as they lay out street networks and bike and pedestrian facilities, how to make those work together and accommodate the usage, not only today, but looking forward as well. So it really, I think, challenges multiple communities in construction, design, urban planning to really, think in ways that are outside the box, collaborate in new and different ways. And I think, as we've evolved and there's been more demand for those types of facilities, we're seeing some really innovative approaches take hold.
Damon, what are the concerns or complaints you hear most often from riders about Indianapolis and you know?
I would say that the number one complaint that I hear from riders and from people who want to become riders is the lack of connectivity of our network. Indianapolis has over 100 miles of bike lanes and over another 100 miles of trails and greenways, but they're not connected together in a way that you can go from A to B using those facilities. And Scott kind of alluded to it. Those facilities go down as a part of the normal road maintenance and construction process. Mm-hmm. So if they're going to repave 2 miles of a street, they look at that and say, what can we do to accommodate bicyclists and pedestrians on this 2 miles that we're authorized to work on? Mm-hmm. So for motorists, it's great because the road's already continuous. But for cyclists, you're getting a new 2 miles of bicycle facility that goes essentially from nowhere to nowhere until they come along and do the next 2 miles and the next 2 miles. So the real concern for cycling is being able to connect the network so that it actually can be used to get around.
Kim, is that because I don't hear it as often as I once did, but, you know, when a lot of the first efforts were made to create dedicated bike lanes mm-hmm. and some major, you would hear that argument, the argument in response to this that, well, why are we doing this? Because no one's using them. And in part, it was because of the reason the Damon's advanced here that, you know, has that begun to diminish or is that still a sort of force of resistance?
Yeah, it's a great point. So I think there's a couple aspects of that. One is where people are seeing that a bikeway or a sidewalk or whatever is being built where it doesn't connect to anything, right? And again, it's like, why are we doing this? Well, it's the long-term view, right? We're taking a long-term approach, and we know that over a period of time, it will connect. Right now is the most opportune, cost-effective time to do it, and so we build it now. But again, that isn't intuitive to people who aren't doing this work. The other thing is that we kind of joke in our world, like, you don't often see, you know, you don't hear about transportation departments building a bridge based on how many people are swimming across a river, right? Mm-hmm. So that demand for use may not show. It may not be clear that there are people who would walk or bike because it's so unsafe or so, you know, such a barrier to doing it. But once the infrastructure is there, it opens up a whole, you know, sort of new group of people who are willing to do it. So, you know, we talk a lot, and I'm sure I've said here before, like, we focus on both the infrastructure and the cultural side of that. And shifting of cultural norms, making it more, again, just routine for people to think about walking or biking to go where they need to go. And again, the infrastructure drives that so much, but we also are changing attitudes, comfort levels, that kind of thing.
Kim, I'm going to stay with you, but sure. How much since you're talking about changing a mindset, I'm thinking here also, how much of it is, you know, we sort of take the roads as just a given.
Right.
When in fact, you know, at some level, they were a massive subsidy for the automotive industry. You know, kind of vehicular traffic wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't been building these kinds of roads and government was the only entity that could have taken it on. You know, that is one of the other arguments that you hear is that why should we subsidize bike riders at some level? What is your response to that?
Sure. So again, complicated issues and a lot of misperception. Many people think that the gas tax, which we pay, is solely used to fund roadways. And the reality is that at the federal level, state level, even locally, the gas tax is only paying for a fraction, maybe half is the last number I heard in terms of the true cost of our transportation network. And so we pay for the rest of that through our income tax, sales tax, that kind of thing. And so to say that because somebody walks or they bike, they're not contributing is just not true. They are contributing in other ways. Most people walking or biking also do drive a car too, so they're paying that. The other thing I think is that we need to continue to make the case, and because it's true, and but we haven't thought about it this way for so long, that just like sewer infrastructure or fire departments and police departments, transportation options of all types, not just for vehicles, single occupancy vehicles, are legitimate infrastructure, or that is legitimate infrastructure. And so the ability for someone to walk where they need to go, to take transit, a bus, or even a rail where they need to go, is no different than them being able to access fire or police services or sewer services.
If you are just joining us, tomorrow is Bike to Work Day, and in anticipation of that occasion, we're talking today on No Limits about efforts to make Indianapolis more bike-friendly. My guests are Kim Irwin, she's Executive Director of Health by Design, Damon Richards, who is with Bike Indianapolis, and Scott Manning, who is with the Indiana Department of Transportation. If you want to join the conversation, there are several ways you can do that. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about efforts to make Indianapolis more bike-friendly. Tomorrow is Bike to Work Day, which is what gives us the hook for the show. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI. Or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kim Irwin, Executive Director of Health by Design, Damon Richards with Bike Indianapolis, and Scott Manning with the Indiana Department of Transportation. We have an email from a listener named Barry, and again, our email address, if you want to join the conversation that way, is nolimits@wfyi.org. Barry writes, "Hi, John, great show. My wish list for safe biking downtown is to do away with a right turn on red for cars. Example, the cultural trail on Washington crossing West Street. There are two right turn lanes. Drivers are always craning their necks to the left, looking for an opening from the northbound traffic, often not looking to the right when turning on red. I have had so many close calls there." Damon, you're nodding your head in sympathy here.
Yes. And Barry, I want to tell you that you and all of your friends should contact your city councilor and make that case. There was an attempt earlier in this year to eliminate right turn on red in all of downtown, and it did not pass. So make sure your representatives know that that's what you want. It's very true that it's incredibly dangerous, and Kim can probably speak to that more because it's far more dangerous to pedestrians than even a cyclist.
Kim, I think that's your cue.
Yeah, sure, and I'll just echo that. We do know from crash analysis we've done around where people get hit when they're walking, that turning movements by cars, both right and left, are a significant feature when that's happening. And so those turning movements and conflict points that come with that are so critical. As Damon said, there was an attempt to prohibit turns on red, both right and left turns in the downtown area through the City-County Council actually late last year and into early this, and it did not have the support it needed to move at the committee level. And then, frankly, with upcoming elections and changes, some of those political aspects, it hasn't been pursued further at this point. It's absolutely on our policy agenda and something that we will come back to.
Scott, I'm going to ask because, this gets into the place where you've got competing agendas, and at some level you've got to decide on priorities. It's not like, most of the places in this country adopted right turn on red laws, 40, 50 years ago, just on a whim. They did so because it was a way to speed traffic flow, to keep cars from idling at intersections and reducing pollution. Here you've got two, sort of legitimate imperatives. How do you decide which one takes priority?
Well, I think it's a tough balance, and it's also, there's a multi-jurisdictional component to that discussion where, in the example that that Barry mentioned, Washington and West Street, that's a an intersection of two local streets, so it's maintained by the city of Indianapolis, and the city is responsible for making the decisions about whether to limit right turn on red and considering the ramifications of whether to do that. But I think the key to discussions like that and making changes not only to the physical face of our infrastructure, but sort of the way we manage traffic from a policy and from an enforcement standpoint, is really just an extension of the education discussion. So I think it's more a need to continue to help both pedestrians, bicyclists, and motorists understand what the needs are of all users and balancing those. And I think it is also a product to get to the heart of the question of whether or not to make that change. I think I don't want to speak for the elected officials on the council as they weigh that, but I think we're seeing over time the evolution of the way people use our infrastructure downtown changing, where maybe 10, 15 years ago the need wasn't there, or the perception was that the need wasn't there to kind of restrict that right turn on red movement to give a more predictable nature for bicycle and pedestrian use on the cultural trail there. The cultural trail didn't exist at that time. So we've seen, we've seen the network change downtown, and I think it's just a matter of the policy side catching up. I think that's, something you see across the board is the speed of commerce and the speed of life is oftentimes light years ahead of where policy and governance sometimes is. And I think that's probably the case in this example, too.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about efforts to make Indianapolis more bike friendly in anticipation of Bike to Work Day tomorrow. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Attila has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Attila, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been an avid mountain biker, and I also ride on the road. And whenever I can, I'm just trying to be a defensive driver because the city is not really designed to ride around on a bike. And I really miss the connectivity which you already spoke about. I think rather than doing a bike to work day, we would need to create corridors where people can get out and try the bikes. Just put them out there on bike, designated bike roads to try it out.
Thanks very much for the call and the suggestion, Attila. Kim, you're nodding your head.
Sure. Thank you for that comment. I think one of the things that we can also speak to, as Scott mentioned, how the speed of life accelerates. The engineering, the planning, the building of bicycle infrastructure has changed dramatically over a relatively short period of time. Mm-hmm. We know much more now than we did even 5, 8, 10 years ago about what both encourages use but also keeps people safe. And so it is true that, we are needing to even to upgrade or to make changes to the bike infrastructure that's come online just, again, in the last 10 years or so, with the bike lanes being the best example. The evidence is very clear that protected bikeways, separated bikeways, are best. Again, they make people feel safer, which encourages mm-hmm. their ridership, but also truly does keep them safer. And so we were very fortunate, again, going back over the last decade, that a lot of bike lanes have been striped in this city, but we increasingly understand that there's still a relatively narrow group or a small group of riders who will ride that. Whereas when you have separated trails or you have these protected paths, it's better. So I think, again, just speaking back to why it's so important to stay on top of design changes, sort of the evidence base, the best practices around how we build, construct, and even retrofit these streets.
I want to stay with you for a second, Kim, but I'll give Damon a chance. When you talk about the things we now know, as opposed to even 6 to 8 years ago, what are some of the other revelations about things that promote both safety and bike usage?
Sure. So I am going to look to Damon for help here, too. I mean, protected intersections are a really important piece as well, and I'm not sure that I can describe it well, but it essentially gives people walking and biking, specifically in this case, both positioning in the intersection, lead time, and sort of a way of being more visible to vehicle traffic. So again, I think that separation and that visibility in terms of location on the roadway or in the intersection are the things I'm most aware of.
Damon.
A really important piece that we are still coming to grips with is what Scott talked about earlier, just one of education. Like, I can tell every listener out there how they learned to ride a bike. Mm-hmm. Somebody who cared about them held onto the back of their seat and ran down a sidewalk and let go. That was the end of their bicycle education. It's no wonder that when you say, okay, now take your bike and go ride with traffic, people, their heart rate goes up and they think there's no way. That's crazy. I'm not going to do it. There's a huge comfort and confidence level presented by good road safety education. And that's something that we here in Central Indiana have kind of overlooked in our press to get better bicycle infrastructure and separate bicycle infrastructure. But as Kim said earlier, riders don't ride on the streets because they don't feel safe. Mm-hmm. And the advantage to us in the advocacy community is that safety is a subjective feeling. Mm-hmm. So if by education I can make you feel safer, you are more likely to go ride, even if I didn't give you the best infrastructure to ride on.
So where should they go to get that education?
That's going to start this summer, a partnership between Bike Indianapolis and the Central Indiana Bicycle Association. We're going to start producing monthly bicycle safety training classes for those who want to learn how to ride on our city streets. The first class is scheduled for July 6th, and right now, it's so tentative, there's no information online, but they'll be able to get information at our website, bikeindianapolis.org, and probably also at the SEBA website, SEBARide.org.
Would there be a cost to taking the classes?
Right now, there is a cost, but we're working on getting some sponsorship to either defray or eliminate those costs.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about efforts to make Indianapolis more bike-friendly in anticipation of Bike to Work Day tomorrow. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Mike has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I know people have been talking about some good dramatic shifts to our infrastructure, such as, you know, getting rid of the right turns or putting roads on a diet and making some changes. Has anybody looked into ways we can make those changes flexible for, you know, days when it rains or seasons when it's winter and it's snowing outside? And you may have some of those people that are committed to riding on a bike that they go back to the car, and now we've got a road on a diet that really could accommodate those bikers who are now motorists, you know, making different choices from day to day or season to season. How much effort's been put into those type of studies?
Thanks very much for the call and the question. I think that one's directed at you, Scott. Thanks much, Mike.
Well, I would say that technology more and more is affording us some of the flexibility, Mike, that you're talking about, and I don't think we're quite to a level that you described. But you know, I'll use an example, and it's more specific to vehicles. But you know, on the interstate network throughout Indiana, NDOT has what we call ITS, an intelligent transportation system. So we have a camera network and dynamic message boards on the Indiana Toll Road in northern Indiana. Recently, variable speed limits were introduced. So there are now speed limit signs that are dynamic. So during you know, a heavy snow event or, you know, heavy rain or some kind of a scenario where you know, the best thing to do is to slow vehicle traffic down, law enforcement and the operators there can actually change the speed limit lower. So I think that type of technology could be certainly adapted to, you know, maybe let's say there's a scenario where we have a shared You know, maybe there is a lane of a roadway where it's shared between bike and pedestrian traffic during some periods of the day and not others for safety or whatever reason. So I think as technology continues to evolve, and specifically, you know, we continue to have a transportation network that is more connected through cell networks, and we can leverage broadband technology to make changes and adjustments in real time. You know, we have a lot more options and a lot more tools in our toolkit to be creative in how we use kind of that finite physical space to be as accommodating as possible to those, again, multiple modes of transportation.
And I'm going to ask this. I mean, will the, you know, at least anticipated advent of driverless vehicles, automated vehicles, complicate this challenge, or will it make it easier? Because I was looking at Scott, but I see Damon. But you know, I'm thinking, because among other things, that part of what makes, in theory, that possible is that network that Scott's talking about. All of the pieces are talking to each other. When you create bike riders or even pedestrians, you create certain random elements there that are going to be hard to predict.
And that's an issue. There's a yes and no to that answer to that question.
Oh, why am I not shocked?
In Europe, a part of the approval process for self-driving cars is that vehicle is capable of recognizing a bicyclist or a pedestrian and dealing with them. And there's a push here to make sure that that's included in any approval process for self-driving cars, because the alternative is all the self-driving cars have technology to talk to one another. Mm-hmm. And so you put a burden on the pedestrian or the cyclist to add this technology to be able to integrate with that network, or you press that burden back on that self-driving car and say, these are an element of the network and you need to be able to deal with them.
Scott, go ahead, Kim.
I'll just jump in and add that I've heard it talked about that this is really a geometry problem or a spatial issue, right? That particularly in downtown areas and other areas where congestion might be a factor, space is the limitation, right? And so an autonomous vehicle versus a, you know, single occupancy vehicle versus a bike or a person walking, you know, there's a variety there. Mm-hmm. The autonomous vehicle, the driven vehicle take up the same amount of space regardless. A person walking, a person on a bike takes up only a fraction of the space of that. And so when we look at the available right-of-way, the existing right-of-way, and our ability to coexist, you know, share the road within that, when we can prioritize space for people walking and biking, we're actually able to get much better performance, if you will, under certain circumstances to meet the needs of that specific area.
So if we're looking at this, then it sounds like, you know, it adds a layer of complication. Will it delay, do we think, the advent of autonomous vehicles? Or, you know, Damon's shaking his head.
It should not. The only issue is making sure that as a part of the planning process, the manufacturers know that that's a requirement of their vehicle. There's no new technology that needs to be invented. It's all out there.
And in terms of, you know, building the infrastructure, making adjustments for the roads, do you anticipate there are going to be any challenges there with that new wrinkle, Scott?
Well, I think it's the conversation that within the DOT level that NDOT has had and our other state DOT counterparts has been very constructive with the automotive industry and with the autonomous vehicle development community. You know, the conversation we've been having has really been centered around what are the needs from an infrastructure standpoint. And I think that where we're somewhat well positioned is that, you know, this infrastructure this new technology is being developed to be deployed kind of in our current state, but also with a vision toward what's the next evolution look like. So I think we're in a good position, but as Kim and Damon both mentioned, you know, that regulatory piece is really key in making sure we get that right is going to be, I think, critical for that deployment to happen on the timeline that we all are kind of anticipating.
We are talking about ways to make Indianapolis more bike-friendly today on No Limits. My guests are Kim Irwin, Executive Director of Health by Design, Damon Richards with Bike Indianapolis, and Scott Manning with the Indiana Department of Transportation. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, send us an email, or reach out to us via social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about ways that Indianapolis can be made more bike-friendly today on No Limits. Tomorrow is Bike to Work Day. My guests are Kim Irwin, Executive Director of Health by Design, Damon Richards with Bike Indianapolis, and Scott Manning with the Indiana Department of Transportation. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or do what a listener named Jacob has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jacob, you're on the air.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
I'll keep my question very short and brief and straight to the point. I'm an avid rider here and there, but I drive my car more often. But one of the biggest things that I've noticed in Indianapolis, especially on the northern side, is bicyclists, for some reason, just ignore the rules of the road, like stop signs, traffic lights, whether or not they need to ride on the sidewalk or versus the road, et cetera. So my question is, what is Indiana doing to help educate people about the rules of the road more and about what is the law enforcement side trying to do to help prevent those people from running those stoplights or getting hit by a car when they shouldn't be crossing the intersection at that point or something like that? So I'll take my answers off air, but thank you so much.
Thanks very much for the call, Jacob. Damon.
First, I want to point out all the research shows that bicyclists violate the law at the exact same rate as motorists.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that when you're in a car, you don't notice that you or the people around you are speeding or rolling through stop signs or rolling around that right turn on red without stopping at all. But you do notice it when you see a cyclist do it, and so it sticks out more. But the reality is they violate the law at about the same rate. Unfortunately, particularly here in Indianapolis, our law enforcement is overwhelmed with work, and they just can't prioritize those kinds of citations in their time. I personally and have now convinced my board we ought to be pushing for more automated ways to do that. Red light cameras and speed limit cameras could do a lot to slow down vehicles and speed kills. The same needs to happen in the road safety training that I talked about earlier. It covers those things. What are the responsibilities of a cyclist? Because as I said, somebody let go of the back of your seat and you were a bicyclist.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people riding on the street don't know what their responsibility is, so they need to be taught. By the same token, motorists need to know what is their responsibility to other transportation modes and what is their responsibility in reverse. For instance, they should be on the sidewalk. Bicyclists are not required to be on the sidewalk.
Do you think there will come a time, though, when you might need a license to ride a bike? I mean, the public policy argument, obviously, for licensing drivers is that the roads are not your private property. They're the shared thing, and that you know, there have to be some understandings there, that requirements that you understand the risks and costs involved. Kim?
I'll jump in on that. I mean, I think from our perspective, we would certainly hope that would never be the case, primarily because of the equity issues that surround that. Bicycle is a tool, a transportation tool, and certainly a recreational tool as well, for people of all ages, of all abilities. And so to regulate that in any way, it certainly puts a disproportionate burden on some populations than others, particularly then when we look at the enforcement of that. And so I think keeping walking and biking, or biking in this case, sort of accessible to everyone, available to everyone, is a really key aspect of, you know, freedom and independence and active participation in communities. The other thing I would just say is that we work really hard, and I have to do it myself, even with this work, is that it is very easy to put the blame on to blame the victim, essentially, to put the blame on the person walking or the person biking for various reasons. And the reality is, while a crash is traumatic under any circumstances, a person riding a bike, a person walking, is rarely going to do damage to anyone but themselves, right? Our roadways, our culture, the way driving has changed over a period of many years. Speeds have increased. We move faster. Our roadways are wider. There's just, a much different environment. And that risk is held by the person, or the responsibility, I should say, is held by the person driving the vehicle that will kill others, right? And that, again, is rarely the bicyclist. And
Let me push back a little bit on that. And I say this, I was a competitive triathlete for years, mm-hmm. and did a lot of riding. And I know, for example, when I was out at Eagle Creek State Park and I'd be doing training rides routinely on the bicycle, particularly on downhills, I would exceed the speed limit. And, you know, I'm a reasonably large human being. Mm-hmm. If I had hit a walker or a jogger on that bicycle, yes, the damage would not have been as great as a car, but it would have hurt that person a lot.
No question.
Possibly killed him or her. And I think that was kind of the spirit of mm-hmm. the question, too, is, you know, what mechanisms do we have in place when it is the cyclist who violates the law? You know, no one should be running a red light. No one should be. Correct. Yeah. Damon?
And I think the solution to that, again, is one of better education, making sure that people know what their responsibilities and rights are with whatever mode of transportation they're mm-hmm. using. We're trying to really make a dent in that with our bicycle safety education. Bike Indianapolis has also introduced this year a program we call the Bicycle Friendly Driver, which is essentially a program to teach a non-cyclist who drives a vehicle on the street what it's like to share the road with a cyclist. To give both sides of the story, mm-hmm. what are you responsible to do, and what is that cyclist responsible to do, so that we can share the facilities without crashing into one another?
Got some emails. I'm going to ask everybody here, panelists, and I've got a full bank of phone calls and a bunch of emails here. So everybody, let's try to be tight on both questions and answers. This email is from a listener named David. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. David writes, I noticed soil boring locations along the Monon, mm-hmm. north and south of 38th Street. Are they thinking of elevating the trail over 38th? That would be great. So dangerous. I ride daily all year round. My company actually pays us to ride. It has significantly reduced our health care costs, allowing us to be self-insured. Yeah. Damon.
That's awesome. I hope more companies start doing that. Yes, those borings are in preparation for a widening of the Monon. The Monon is going to be widened by 4 feet all the way from 10th Street to 96th Street, and they're going to put a bridge over 38th Street.
So that will mean no more dismounting to cross.
Correct.
which will be good. We're talking about ways to enhance bike-friendly Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Mary has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mary, you're on the air.
I used to ride my bike through Indianapolis from the Fountain Square area to work at the medical center in the 70s. And then the biggest hazards were dogs on the loose, and especially non-conscious drivers who'd open the door and get out of the car in the bike lane. I had to watch very carefully for them. But now I think we should be thinking in terms of more and more people riding bikes. And so to your questions about education, I was surprised that you didn't say that they were on the web, because that's the easiest way to make it accessible to children and adults. Another comment, I when you talked about licensing, I think the licensing of K through 8th grade people could be done by the public schools, and it could be a great help in education.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the call, Mary. Take care. So, Scott, I realized I did not get your point of view as the one government official here, really. I probably ought to see on the idea of licensing, because that does give you a way to track and see if there are persistent violators or anything like that.
Well, I think Kim hit on some great points, and I think there is obviously, there's a discussion to be had about, you know, kind of the potential or I guess the risk associated with a crash from a pedestrian or bicyclist standpoint, versus the impact from a vehicle, and how that weighs into whether to consider doing a licensing, putting some kind of a licensing program in place. But I thought that Mary made a great point, and maybe it's not to the formal level of having schools, go to the extent of issuing licenses. But I know in K through 12 education, that there's been great progress in incorporating, education programs related to bicycling and how to walk safely on the street network. So I think continuing to make progress in that area that will also have a positive result.
Gotten an email from a listener named Pat who says, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Pat writes, another factor that reduces bike safety, excessive window tinting. If I cannot see the driver's face to confirm they are aware of me, I am at risk as a bicyclist or pedestrian if I try and proceed legally across the roadway. I also do not trust the bike lane along bus routes. Too many times I see Indigo drivers illegally cross the line. They are not alone. I see other vehicles use the lanes to merge from turns or to make right turns. Damon.
Yes, you could see all of that and more. And I sound like I'm being a dead horse, but a big part of that is education. People don't know how they're supposed to interact with this new infrastructure. And I believe that if we teach them, we'll see everybody using it better.
Go ahead, Scott. Were you leaning in?
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, well, I think, some of it, there's culture changing in the way we use vehicles, and the culture's changing in terms of bike pedestrian infrastructure. And we keep going back to downtown Indianapolis, where, 15 years ago, we didn't have the cultural trail, and we didn't have parking protected bike lanes in some areas like we have on Pennsylvania Street, and we didn't have the striped in bike lanes. And, as that infrastructure, becomes visible, as it starts to be used more, I think that change, the awareness of that infrastructure being there and folks using that infrastructure will in itself, again, coupled with education, kind of change the way we all, whether we're driving a car, riding a bicycle, walking, it will change the way we use the transportation network. It will change the way we think, and I think it will also kind of change the way we view safety. So I think it's, along with education, as Damon talked about, I think it's a matter of awareness also.
We are talking about ways to make Indianapolis more bike-friendly today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Brad has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brad, you're on the air.
Hey, yes. I wanted to talk about roundabouts, particularly in the Fishers and Carmel area as they relate to the north side of Indianapolis. I'm a big bike enthusiast. I rode my bike to school when I was teaching. Now I'm retired. And what I really notice is it's difficult, I'm sure, for non-bike riders to judge the speed of bikes that are entering the roundabouts from either lane, particularly the inside lane, and to know what the intention of the rider is going to be. And just the other day, I was coming up to a roundabout, and I'm in the inside lane. Somebody is next to me in the outside lane. A bike is coming across. We don't know if she's going to curve around or go straight, and she actually indicated that she was going straight. And I thought, that's great information for me as a driver to know what that rider's going to do. There happened to be a school bus in her right-hand lane, so she was not behind the school bus. And we have to remember that bikes aren't always on the right side of the road. Sometimes in a roundabout, they can be on the inside circle, and we just have to be aware of that. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Brad. Kim, you were nodding your head.
Just that roundabouts present unique challenges, and it's great to hear sort of the suggestions that were embedded in his comments. I think conflict points, as we call them, mm-hmm. I think that's the engineering term. I mean, that's the key, right? So anytime you've got people crossing paths at an intersection, moving lanes, that kind of thing, we just all have to be extra aware, extra sensitive, reduce our speeds as much as possible, and really, again, be as predictable as possible, but also know how to use the infrastructure, know how to
communicate,
how to communicate, and how to behave well in our lane, literally.
We are getting very close on time, but I'm going to try to squeeze one more call in. Richard, you are on the air, but
yes.
Again, we have very little time, so if you could be quick, I'd appreciate it.
Two quick items. One is I want to thank Jameson Hutchins for getting the Pennsylvania Street segregated bike lane. And the other is that while I'm in favor of bike lanes, I'm also in favor of railroads and getting a nickel plate trail and the nickel plate railroad and also out to Speedway would be excellent uses of land. And for all the talk about bicycle and cars, having bicycle and rail would be an excellent way to go for a healthy, happy, growing city. My two comments.
Thanks very much for the call and the comments. And, you know, how much of this –
can
go
I
ahead,
quick
Dan.
On it? The situation with the nickel plate is still up in the air, although all indications are it is only going to be a multi-use path. There's not going to be rail there. But the Speedway piece that he mentioned in the next-gen trails that just got awarded, Speedway was awarded $4.9 million to extend the B&O trail. So that's going to happen.
Huge effort.
So, I mean, how much, we keep coming back to the fact that this is going to have to require a change of mindset.
Absolutely.
Because what we're thinking about now is really integrating bicycling into a system that already exists. Correct, Scott?
In some cases, yes. But, you know, we have a growing trail network, around the state, regionally and around the state. Damon just mentioned the next level trails program through Department of Natural Resources, through Governor Holcomb's initiative. $90 million once that program is fully doled out have a huge impact in, you know, taking existing trails and creating connections, connecting communities by trail in ways that we don't have today. So some of it is retrofitting our existing infrastructure, but some of it is building, again, that dedicated infrastructure.
Okay, and if people want to participate on Bike to Work Day tomorrow, how do they do that, Dan?
Go to bikeindianapolis.org. At the bottom of the page and upcoming events, there's a icon they can click on for Bike to Work Day.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Kim Irwin, who is Executive Director of Health by Design, Damon Richards, who is with Bike Indianapolis, and Scott Manning with the Indiana Department of Transportation. I'm sorry we didn't get to every question we got here. I'm sure my guest would be willing to take them on our Facebook page after the program goes off the air. And I want to thank my listeners, as always, for some really great questions and comments. It's fun doing radio for really, really smart people. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.